painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Now, here's Terry Tenseth with today's Artbeat.
Today on Artbeat, we visit with local author Richie Swanson. We learn about how a bicycle trip across the United States spawned a novel and other pieces of writing. Richie will share with us his unique writing process, adventures he's had across country, and more. I'm Terry Tenseth, and you're listening to Artbeat. Hi, you're listening to Artbeat with Terry Tenseth. Today I have local author Richie Swanson with me to discuss a book that you've had out for a little while.
Sunstone Press ran it in May on 2013.
Okay, great. And give us the title and why you decided to write this piece of work.
The title of the book is First Territory. It takes place in Washington and Oregon territories in 1855, opens during a treaty council that actually caused war with about five or six different tribes, even caused war with the Nez Perce as late as 1876, 21 years later.
Okay, so this is a historical piece.
It's a historical piece, and it was inspired by the memoirs of a guy named Andrew Splawn, who was in Yakima country. It concerns mainly the Yakima tribe in the 1850s, and he was present at the Treaty Council and was also present during the conflict that ensued after that. He also fell in love with an Indian girl as soon as he got to Yakima. So it was rich material to begin with.
Some people don't know where Yakima territory is. Could you please describe that?
Okay. Yakima is a tribe that lived along the Columbia River and the Walla Walla River in Washington. They ranged north up almost into Spokane.
Why was it important for you to go ahead and write this book?
Well, I became inspired as a writer by taking long-distance bike trips. I started taking bike trips throughout the North America in 1977. And I guess the life-changing thing happened on a reservation in Minnesota, on the White Earth Indian Reservation. When I stopped at a resort, I couldn't understand why there were no Indians on the Indian reservation.
Right.
And then I encountered some very bigoted language in a cafe. And then I rode about 10 miles down the road, and an Ojibwa man called me to the side of the road and explained to me all about the wooden rice mill that he was making and all about the culture of his people, which was a history that I had not learned in school and certainly hadn't learned watching television shows like Bonanza.
Exactly. So then this kind of sparked an interest in you, and you decided to do more research?
Well, as I continued bicycling west that year, I crossed several more reservations, and I essentially the same thing happened again and again. It was also 1978. It was a recession. Things were really hard on all the reservations that I bicycled across, but the Indians were always really nice to me. They showed me the safe places to sleep and the good places to eat and told me about their cultures. And I bicycled long distance even into my 50s. I was in my 20s then, and I started on purpose going across Indian reservations to kind of get to know the Native American population. And I was curious. I mean, you go through Suislaw, Oregon. Well, there's no Suislaw people there. Or you go through Coos Bay, Oregon. There's no Coos Indians there. And in the 70s, about the time that I started to ride, tribal history started to come out. The baby boomers wrote them mostly. So I started to read tribal histories. And as I read tribal histories of the Pacific Northwest, the 1855 Treaty Council came up again and again.
Over and over, right?
Yeah. And what that did essentially was it divided the interior of the Pacific Northwest into reservations between the Yakima and the Palouse and the Walla Walla Indians and the Nez Perce and the Spokane Indians and the Cayuse Indians. And it caused a war because there was a dishonest governor who assured the Indians that their lands would not be open for settlement until the treaties were ratified. Well, as always, Congress was slow in ratifying the treaties, and the governor went right home to Olympia and published in the newspaper that the lands were open for settlement. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of many causes. And the other fascinating thing was there was a general, and General Wool, he was in charge of the Pacific Northwest and the Pacific Coast, and almost nobody lived out there at that time. And he didn't like the idea of war with the Indians. He thought it was a really bad idea. But governor after governor, it happened in Minnesota, it happened in Oregon, it happened in Washington, Colorado, other states. Governor after governor, when they got appointed as governor of territories, they wanted the Indians out of the way. And they fought wars based on policies of extermination. And there was General Wool. He thought it was a bad idea. For one thing, he had a small force. There were thousands of warriors. He didn't want to put his men unnecessarily in harm's way and in battles he couldn't win. And he just had a moral objection to it. And so my main character, who is called Andrew Eaton, is based not only on Splawn, but on a 16-year-old who also wrote his memoirs, who interpreted at that Walla Walla Council. The officials grabbed whoever could speak in Indian language and paid him $5 in gold a day, which was an immense amount of money
back then,
to interpret for the Indians at the council. So, and all these people, they were kind of torn. I mean, you know, everybody's an individual, and they had some people wanted the Indians out of the way, but had this sense that they were being unfairly treated. And then after some blood is shed, that all goes away. My character, Andrew, falls in love with an Indian woman, Lalul, and is also very important because he has spent some time with Chief Kamiokin, who was rumored to have organized a great confederation of Indians against Washington and Oregon territories. There's really no evidence that that happened.
Nothing that you could find.
No. And I wrote the book after the online book business hit its boom, and all of a sudden, everything was available. When I started to write fiction, maybe I would have to find a book for $100 or $200, a rare book, go through a rare book dealer. Now everything is just there.
Oh, yeah.
Mostly in PDF, or the new library here at Winona State opened. The librarians, you know, gave me great help, and the librarians at Winona Public Library, all of a sudden, everything was accessible.
Oh, yeah.
So my character gets torn because he's interpreting for the general and he's in love with an Indian woman. So he's kind of working two sides at the same time. His loyalties are split. It's a very harsh split because the conflict that ensues is based on extermination. So he has to ride along with the governor, who's based on Isaac Stevens in Washington Territory, and he left his memoirs too, and his son left his memoirs too. So everything was very well laid out. And another person was Phil Sheridan, was a young lieutenant, the general later in the Civil War, and he left very detailed accounts of the battles that happened in First Territory.
Was this your first writing endeavor?
No, I had about 15 short stories published, along with some bird conservation articles, since the late 90s. I've had 5 short stories published from the Upper Miss, based on the Winona area. And my mentor was Robert Olin Butler. I met him at a Port Townsend Writers Conference in 1991. And he agreed to work by phone and mail with me. I would send him short stories, and he would send me back cassette tapes and tell me how boring they were.
Oh. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome. But always, he was always very positive. He always started positive, and then
he hits you over the head with the negative.
And then he lowered the boom, so to speak. But always with very good suggestions.
Okay.
So that was invaluable. And after I started to work with him, then I started to have some success with short stories.
Okay, great. And the process for writing this longer piece of work, what was the learning process for you with that?
Well, I had written a novel before then, which actually won a piece writing award in 2000. It did not get, unbeknownst to each other, it was in three big offices at New York on the same week. And it was about the daughter of a nuclear weapons designer who had an objection to what he did. And because the weapons that he was designing were preemptive. So it was about her moral quandary. Excerpts have been published. And when it was in the three offices in New York at once, the planes hit the Trade Tower. And that was the end of anybody wanting a novel about about the United States having too many missiles.
Yeah.
So I had written a novel before, but essentially when I started to write First Territory, I had become kind of proficient at the 5,000-word story, which was the limit of a lot of literary journals.
Okay.
And that's what Robert Butler wrote a lot of. So I learned from him. And this story just would not fit within the 5,000 words. And so I just gave into it.
Right. Why push it?
Yeah. And the same thing is happening right now. I'm working on a long novel, three or four times as long as First Territory, that happens here from 1820 to 1828.
Excellent.
And it was the same thing. In the 1820s, the 1812 war is over. The United States has seized control of the upper Mississippi, and the U.S. Army and the American Fur Company move in to grab not only, at that time, the fur resources, the trade. So it was a time of great change for the Indians. So my novel happens here from 1820 to 1828. Almost all of it happens on the river, I'm happy to say.
Now, what spawned this whole I'm going to write across the country thing?
Well, people were doing it in the late 70s.
So this is a thing, huh?
The 1976 was the bike centennial when the United States celebrated its 200-year anniversary. There were a lot of people who celebrated that by biking across the country. Well, the first time I biked long distance was 1977. I was 23. I had no patience for a classroom inside a university. I needed to be free and find my own story. And I was a loner. I didn't exactly want to ride with a bunch of people. So I just took off on my bike one day. And then during my first bike trip, I passed through Winona in 1977, stayed at Prairie Island Campground. It happened to be July 4th, and it was a loud mess. A drunk ran over my tent in a bike in the middle of the night, but I loved Winona anyway, and I stayed. I came back and looked in 78, and by 1980, I had moved here.
Okay.
And it was a great launching off place. I biked to Alaska from here, and I biked numerous times out west, and I would always go down the west coast, and became fascinated with the Oregon coast and redwood country on the California coast, and that history unfolded a little bit differently. There were tribes that had absolutely no contact with whites until the 1855, until after the gold rush, and they were really roughly treated, but their histories were written. And the histories of all those, the county histories of all the towns on Western Oregon and Northern California were also written. So there was just rich material. I wrote maybe one story. I worked in a fish cannery in Alaska, and I wrote a story called So Hard Pulls the Inside. And it is about a fellow who works at a fish cannery and falls in love with a stoic, beautiful woman who he doesn't know it, but is being abused by a very aggressive man there. And so I wrote a little bit about myself, but history drew me more.
Okay.
I will admit, I'm an activist. I've been part of peace groups for 30 years. I co-chaired the Green Party here in Winona County. And I kind of gave up on the contemporary world after we invaded Iraq. It just is not the way I would have solved the problem of terrorism and the problem of all the conflicts we have with Middle East cultures. But I was powerless to change any of that, and so I just started writing historical fiction instead of worrying about the contemporary world.
Right, right. What have been some of the most fascinating things you've experienced throughout your travels?
There was a lot of things. I went to Hannibal because I was a great Mark Twain fan.
Ah.
I did notice in Hannibal at that time, that was in 1978, that the city embraced the Tom Sawyer, Becky Thatcher story a lot more than it did Huckleberry Finn and his acceptance of a Negro as his surrogate father in Jim. All the billboards were about Tom and Huck, and all the restaurants were named after Tom and Huck. And most of the business stayed away from that story, at least at that time. And then after I rode through reservations for about 7 more years, I read Tom Sawyer again, and I didn't like it anymore because I didn't like the treatment of Injun Joe in it. I thought Mark Twain, he transcended his culture in Huckleberry Finn because he could see through the values of his culture and accept Jim as his surrogate father, a Negro slave as his surrogate father. But when it came to Injun Joe, he was described continuously in satanic terms, and he was also, ironically, the villain at the graveyard when really what was happening at graveyards were whites were stealing skulls and having them measured and sending them to London. But in Twain's story, the guy who commits the unforgivable crime at the graveyard is Injun Joe. And Twain, at the end of the novel, did what most 19th century whites wanted to have happen to the Indians. They wanted to pretend they weren't here. He locks them up into a cave eternally. He's gone out of sight, out of mind. So that was kind of I always had my nose in a book in a cafe or a nose in a book at a campground if I wasn't burdened or talking to somebody. I kind of had a literary experience of the United States. I would visit any birthplace that I could, Carl Sandburg's birthplace or John Steinbeck's birthplace, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So,
for you, how do you go about writing? Like, what's your process?
A lot of times I hear a voice. First of all, I'll say, not to sound too quirky, but another mentor of mine, I slept in a cemetery in Fort Smith, Arkansas in 1985 on a moonlight night, and I listened to a mockingbird. And I thought I could identify every song that the mockingbirds sing all night on a moonlight night. And I thought I could identify every song that mockingbird sang. Well, he sang hundreds of songs that I didn't understand. But I learned from birds and the mockingbird that you could sing any song that you wanted to, and you could improvise it any way you wanted to. It might have been a small thing, but I didn't learn it in English class. I had to learn it from the world of birds. Well, and so a lot of times I'll hear a voice. I'll hear a voice from a memoir, or I'll hear a voice from years ago that somebody in some rural situation in Montana or Oregon spoke. I'll hear the sound of their voice and maybe the twang of their dialect. And that'll get me going. And then I free associate a lot from history, from memoirs, from events. My character kind of comes to me automatically.
Okay.
But plot was always my deficiency before I worked with Robert Butler. So I get plot from history. And Butler kind of encouraged me to accept the challenge of plot. You know, especially in the 80s and the late 70s, there's a lot of, well, if a murder happens in your novel, maybe you're being sensationalist and not literary. Well, I learned to put that not to worry about that kind of thing and to associate from history and memoirs. But also, Bob Butler taught me to dream scenes. And I'm a I'm a vivid dreamer. I'm a lucid dreamer at night. I'm aware I'm dreaming. I dream a lot. And I'm able to transport that experience when I sit down in front of a word processor and dream out a sequence of scenes that will make a short story or a novel. It always changes. It's always flexible. I once offered to give Bob Butler an outline of a novel, and he said he would tear it up, which is a good thing, because you don't want to be predictable.
Right.
You want to be loose, and you want to discover whatever you can discover in that you work. And then I chisel language. After I have a story dreamt out, and after I hear a voice strong enough, then I chisel language. And the 5,000 word short story was good for that, because it, you know, it made me, my kind of grandiose goal was, okay, you can put a novel inside a 5,000 word short story. Of course, that's not true, but you can pack a lot in there. So that was kind of my goal. And
so you're in process of writing something about our area.
Yes.
Currently.
Yeah.
And any plans for travel for you again, or?
No, I was just with my partner Barbie. We were just in Chaco Canyon, looking at ruins from you know 900 to 1100, 1200 AD that are all aligned with the 19-year cycle of the moon and solstices and equinoxes and everything like that. So we just got back from celebrating her birthday there, and before that we were on the coast. But winter is really my time to. I hope I'm 80% done with the river novel. All right. It happens from Fort Crawford, Prairie du Chien, to Fort Snelling, St. Paul. I put a trading post right here, halfway between the two. Actually, a trading post was a little north of here, closer to Alma, but I put it right here because this is the area I'm familiar with. And the young trader, it's a coming-of-age story of sorts. Unlike Andrew in the first territory, he falls in love with an Indian woman, with a Dakota woman, and marries her and has two children and stays with them during the 8 years of tumultuous change that occur. So that's, I'm only going to travel through my word processor and up and down the river for the next maybe 9 months until I finish that.
Great. If people want to find out more information about you, what website would you send them to?
RichieSwanson.com. There is all the stories on the upper Mississippi, Injun Joe and Princess Winona, Indian Pictures, Eden Never Heard, and other river stories are there, and all my Oregon coast stories. Plus, there is a lot of information about upper Mississippi birds, because there are times that I work as a bird watcher, call it an amateur ornithologist who counts birds and goes out and documents endangered nests. So there's information there on RichieSwanson.com too.
And I just want to point out that it's Richie without a T.
Thank you. I was. I know. even the grandest editors in the world write you from big publishing houses, and they put a T in there.
Yep, I know. Well, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Thanks again to Richie Swanson for visiting with us on his novel, First Territory, and other compositions. More information on Richie Swanson can be found at www.richie.com. I'm Terry Tensett, and you've been listening to ArtBeat.
ArtBeat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.